Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I can make all kind of lame Halloween jokes here about how the stock market's been frightening and the economy's ghoulish. But as this October ends, about the only thing left to say really is good riddance. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday, everybody. This one is the last day of October 2008, and about time, too, because it has been a long, slow month of fallout from the financial crisis, and we'll talk about that some today. Also, the back and forth over what banks can do with the bailout money. And as the tab for that bailout gets bigger and bigger, how much does all the red ink really matter? There is an almost existential question at the heart of the bailout package. Once you give a bank money, can you force them to spend it? The Treasury Department has tried. Henry Paulson and the White House have strongly encouraged banks to do what banks are supposed to do, that is, lend money. Those banks, though, do have other things in mind. They've used it to make acquisitions. There are reports it's being spent on bonuses and dividends. That, in turn, has congressional Democrats none too pleased, and they are talking about revisiting the whole thing. So we asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale what the law actually says.
So far, the Treasury Department has distributed $125 billion to nine large banks under the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Representative Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, says the law requires that banks use the money for loans.
You may not use any of these funds to pay dividends or pay rent or pay salaries or pay bonuses or do anything else. That does not stop you from doing your normal work with the money you otherwise had, as long as none of the TARP money is implicated.
The Treasury Department confirms participating banks can pay stock dividends and salary incentives, but not with taxpayer money. Several members of Congress, including Republicans, say Treasury should keep a sharper eye on how the banks are using bailout dollars. The banks aren't commenting, but Wayne Abernathy at the American Bankers Association says some of them didn't want the government's money in the first place.
There's been a lot of arm twisting going on, and a number of banks that I think would have chosen not to participate because of a lot of the baggage that comes along with taking the king's shilling.
Things like limiting dividend payments that he says will drive down the value of bank stock. But Representative Frank is unmoved by the bank's arguments.
They're the ones who have been telling us, well, wait a minute, we can't lend the way we used to. So I'm not sympathetic to the notion that these poor, innocent, pure entities are being picked on.
Frank says the banks had better lend out the money that taxpayers give them. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Monday morning, the Supreme Court is going to take up a case that'll test the idea of who knows best when it comes to consumer protections, the states or federal regulators. The specific issue at hand is whether or not to overturn a punitive damage award against a major pharmaceutical company. But the case could eventually put an end to product liability lawsuits. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
In 2000, Diana Wynne Levine was a healthy musician in Vermont making music like this. One day, she got a migraine. She received a drug called Phenergan made by Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. She'd taken it before.
Only this time, instead of by a shot in the butt, they gave it to me by a method called IV push.
Through that method, the Phenergan leaked from her vein. She got gangrene. Her right arm had to be amputated. Levine says Wyeth should be held responsible.
You know, I've got one index finger left, and I'm pointing it at them, and I'm saying, this is your fault. You made a mistake, so now fix it.
Levine won a multi-million-dollar judgment that was appealed to the Vermont Supreme Court. It found that Wyeth's warning label should have been stronger. The company argues it complied with Food and Drug Administration rules and should be immune from lawsuits. It even argues it can't change the label without FDA approval. Here's Wyeth's attorney, Bert Ryan.
We use the federally approved label, and we were very open with the FDA about the risks of the drug as reflected in the label itself.
Wyeth's case is important for millions of businesses. The court could rule that federal regulations should preempt state law. Preemption, as it's called, would give companies one set of rules to follow. But Fordham Law Professor Benjamin Zapersky says the decision could also limit lawsuits.
That effectively would cut off virtually all pharmaceutical liability for prescription drugs.
Internal documents show some FDA scientists believe state lawsuits can reveal flaws in drug labels. Consumer advocates worry that if Wyeth wins, manufacturers will have less incentive to make their products as safe as possible. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
After what seems like forever, but what has in reality only been about 2 years, we're almost at the end of the presidential campaign, and transition offices are being set up all over Washington, including at the Treasury Department. Secretary Paulson and the gang have prepared briefing books and installed phone lines to let whoever wins on Tuesday move right in and start learning the ropes. But make no mistake, Hank is still going to be in charge, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
No matter who wins next Tuesday, one of the first big decisions the president-elect is likely to make will be naming a new Treasury Secretary. And the stakes couldn't be higher.
Everybody will be watching.
Paul Leitz, a professor at New York University and an expert on presidential transitions.
More than really any cabinet officer in 50 years, this person is going to be watched very closely, and the name of this person is really going to resonate.
At the Treasury Department, planning for the transition is well underway. The chief of staff there, Jim Wilkinson, and senior career civil servants are leading the effort. And Treasury spokesperson Brooklyn McLaughlin says Henry Paulson is in frequent touch with both candidates.
He recognizes that a smooth transition is in the best interest of the financial markets.
But no matter who wins, Paulson will continue to call the shots for more than 2 months after the election. Many major decisions about the bailout are still pending. And even though Obama and McCain have both suggested changes, Light says he doubts they'll get too involved before Inauguration Day.
This is a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. The question is whether the Treasury Secretary designate is going to want to influence policy over the next 2 months.
If the next administration tries to call the shots, it's still Henry Paulson in charge, and the new team could be blamed for his mistakes. But if the newcomers stay out of the debate, they could end up saddled with policies they hate. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but yeah, that was a two-day rally you saw on the Dow. The month gone by, though, not so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Running this country is tough enough even when times are good, but whoever is elected next week to the White House and to Congress is going to inherit a seriously hobbled economy and sky-high deficits. That means presidential ambitions might well have to be curtailed. Commentator Thomas Frank says whether government deficits are good or bad kind of depends on how the money's going to be spent.
This is one of history's great paradoxes. Again and again, we elect deficit-denouncing conservatives to office, and again, they proceed to run up gigantic federal deficits. Why do they do it? Well, for one thing, deficits allow them to reward their constituents. They can cut taxes for the very rich while sluicing money to politically connected contractors. For another thing, deficits allow the conservatives who piled them up to demand that social programs be cut, that government operations be outsourced, that Social Security be privatized. And now we have a conservative Republican running for president who is outraged by the deficits run up by another conservative Republican. That candidate, John McCain, promises, and you guessed it, a balanced budget in his first term in office. After all, his campaign tells us that individual families don't get to run deficits. They have to pay their bills on time, and therefore so should the federal government. So what we need to do is slam on the brakes. McCain's approach would be calamitous. The federal government isn't a family. It's allowed to run deficits when they're called for, and believe me, they're called for right now when we're in recession and everything is contracting. Maybe there's another way of looking at the problem. Suppose we understand the current deficits that benefited the rich and the well-connected as stupid deficits that didn't stimulate much more than the market for yachts and lobbyists. Smart deficits, on the other hand, would come from federal spending that gets the economy going again, spending money on infrastructure, on stabilizing the housing market, and on a massive energy independence program. That's the kind of energetic and intelligent governing we so urgently need today. Look, the alternative is to deliberately bring on some economic day of judgment. But the right answer to our problems is not to steer for an iceberg while shouting, "Every man for himself."
Thomas Frank is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. His latest book is called The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. If you've got some thoughts you'd care to share with us, drop us a line. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Wall Street kicked October out the door today with a relatively mild send-off, a 144-point gain on the Dow. Not much, given how topsy-turvy the blue chips have been over the past 30 days, and a happier ending than the rest of the month might actually deserve. To talk about the week and month that was, we've invited back Diana Enriquez of the New York Times and Andy Brooks. He's the chief trader at T. Rowe Price in Baltimore, Maryland. Hello to you both.
Hi there.
Hi there, Kai.
All right, Andy, we start with you. You're the trader amongst us, and I want to ask you about volatility, about this crazy up and down and insane last hours in the trading day, and what really we should take away from that.
It's really unfortunate. Heightened volatility causes just a lot of anxiety for investors, and it makes people nervous. This thing that's been happening in the last hour of the trading day for the last couple of weeks, what's that all about? There's something called the VIX, which is a volatility index. And when it was trading at 70, which it was a couple days ago, it would have expressed the expectation that the markets could move 20% within the next 30 days. And that's just a huge number.
Diana, so if volatility is not necessarily a great thing, what are the good signs in the market these days?
Well, I think we can all take some comfort from the fact that the money market fund industry, which has been so battered back in September, does seem to be getting its legs under itself again. If you look at the total amount invested in all kinds of money market funds, it's actually back up above the levels it was at before this great panic hit in mid-September. So I think that's certainly a good sign, despite all the volatility.
What about these things called LIBOR and the TED spread, these measures of short-term credit in the economy? Are those getting better?
They are getting better, and we're actually seeing an increased volume in some of the issuance of short-term notes, which again is an indication that some high-quality businesses are able to go into that short-term market and finance their payroll needs and their needs for short-term cash in larger volumes than they had been able to do just 6 weeks ago.
All right, so Andy, when are we going to start seeing some of this credit market easing in the actual equities markets? I mean, it's been a decent couple of days, but when is it going to get serious?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think we're starting to see a period towards more normal behavior. One of the things that's challenging, though, is we're living in a world that expects instant gratification for everything. And this global coordinated financial rescue package that's going on, it's going to take some time.
Diana, let me ask you this question. You know, one of the things we say on this broadcast from time to time is that the stock market really is not the economy because it's, you know, the Dow's 30 lousy companies and all that. What about the fact, though, that with so many people now in the stock markets and with credit and its crisis spreading so deep into the economy, maybe the stock market really is the economy? What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting theory, and I can certainly see some support for it, Kai. If those two entities are being coupled, the link between them is consumer expectations. The shrinkage in home values, the uncertainty about jobs, all of that has to make people less willing to make the kind of, not necessarily leap of faith, but step of confidence. If you look back at the Great Depression, you had a whole generation of people who became so risk averse that it really stifled entrepreneurship in the country for several decades, and it resulted in simply not enough growth in their own assets and earnings to see them into retirement. It would really be terrible if that were to happen again.
All right. Well, on that point, let me do a little gut check before we let you guys go and get you back to the week that was. The Fed came out and cut interest rates. The GDP number came out the other day. Not so great. Diana Enriquez, how you feeling?
Well, it was a little good news, a little bad news joke there, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
I think I felt a little more comforted than worried.
Andy?
Yeah, I'd say I feel better.
Better, but not maybe great.
Well, I'd love to say right. I'd love to say that was the bottom 10 days ago and I'm all in, but you know, we've been tested and retested a few times, and this is a complicated global crisis that we're involved in. So I'm a little bit hesitant to say I'm not still a little nervous, but I think you have to start buying some stocks here and increase your exposure and increase your risk profile a touch, because stock prices are down a whole bunch.
All right. Well, we're going to save this tape and play it back for you in a couple of weeks. Andy Brooks at T. Rowe Price in Baltimore. Diana Enriquez at the New York Times in New York City. Thanks, you both.
You bet.
You're welcome.
Coming up, MBA candidates weigh their options.
What's the set of companies in this industry that the school has a relationship with? Do you have alumni in this field? Will alumni talk to me?
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 1.5% today, 144 points, to close at 9,325. The NASDAQ pushed up 1.3%, 22 points, finished at 1720. The S&P 500 ended the day 0.1% higher, 10 points, 964 the close. For the week, both the Dow and the NASDAQ gained around 11%. The S&P 500 climbed 10.5%. J.P. Morgan's announcement that it's going to modify terms on $110 billion in home loans pushed its stock up 9% today. Bank of America gained 6%. Wells Fargo rode up nearly 7%. Morgan Stanley finished the day up more than 8% today. Burger King reported a 2% rise in profits for the third quarter, but the company's shares ended down 1.8% today. Yahoo shares sank nearly 1% on news that its partnership with Google may have been sunk by government antitrust restrictions. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.95%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence. Online at SaveAndInvest.org. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Monday. Georgetown University holds a panel discussion on how systemic risk has affected financial markets. Hong Kong's task force on the global financial crisis meets for the first time. And in 1986, a Lebanese magazine reported that the U.S. was secretly selling weapons to Iran in exchange for American hostages. This would later be known as the Iran-Contra Affair. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's not likely you're going to be buying eggs imported from China the next time you swing by the grocery store, but that's probably just as well. We learned today chicken eggs are the latest Chinese product that has been found to contain melamine, and Beijing said the industrial chemical is regularly being added to animal feed. The food scare is just the latest economic problem China's got to deal with. Although, by most measures, a decade and a half of solid growth for one, things should be pretty good despite these recent setbacks. We've got Marketplace's Scott Tong on the line. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. But listen, we have been wondering, and this is the reason we called you, what life is like in a country where 9% gross domestic product growth, like China's having, is considered not such a great thing.
Well, it does seem like an alternative universe, and I tell you, it kind of feels like it. Because it's so calm when you walk around the streets of Beijing. As I was getting around, I was on a brand new subway, and they're building more here. I walked by a bunch of guys who were flying kites, and they were complaining that traffic is so bad because too many people are buying cars, and the environment is too bad because too much industrial activity is going on, and housing prices are too high because too many people are buying houses. I mean, China's still growing. It's still growing at a good pace, as you say, and that's the dominant feel here.
How can it be, though, that the GDP falls 3% like it did in China, and there isn't more pain?
Well, there is pain. There certainly is pain down south where the factories are, and we've all heard about these Dickensian sweatshops down south. You have factories closing down. About half of the toy factories have closed down in the last year. You have labor problems. But the point is, China's a lot more than factories, and that's the great myth about China, is all they do is make stuff that Americans buy. There's domestic investment. There's a lot of stuff being built all over China. And the view from Beijing is, you know, these sweatshop jobs in the factories, we don't really want them anymore anyway. So we're willing to sacrifice those if we can kind of transition this economy into a more grown-up economy that's more service-oriented, a little more technology, a little more domestic consumption. You know, we can do that.
You have to give the Beijing government credit for managing the economy on the way up. It got hot, but not too hot. It developed in a lot of the ways they wanted it to. What about managing it on the way down now? Are they going to be as successful?
Well, part of the formula for this kind of Goldilocks, you know, not too hot, not too cold, is the same thing, and that is to be somewhat disconnected from the rest of the financial world. And China has erected these financial barriers so they don't get whacked by these market 2x4s every once in a while. It served them well in the Asian financial crisis 10, 11 years ago, and the view is it served them well now. I'm going to play you a piece of tape from Bill McCahill. Now, he's been in China for 20, 25 years, and he works for the consulting firm J.L. McGregor. And here he is explaining this disconnect between China's financial market and the rest of the world.
They've been rather prudent in the kinds of investments they've made with their foreign exchange reserves, which are now approaching $2 trillion. And so in a time of crisis elsewhere, this, in a way, it's another Great Wall of China that's kept them insulated from that.
No, Kai, economists can argue whether this Great Wall is a good or a bad thing, but it's going to stay because the view from China is, you know what? It's worked for us. We're going to keep it up.
Tell me about the expat life. Are other foreigners who live in your apartment building losing their jobs? Or are they thinking about going home? What's going on with them?
What's interesting is one of our closest friends is connected to the auto business in the U.S. And the husband just got laid off because of what's happening back home. So you do feel it. And when we walk around and our kids play with other kids, and their parents from all over the world say, you know, we're watching what's happening in the world. We're sure glad we have a job. But for the most part, people still have their jobs. And for the people who have lost them, you know, they don't want to go back to Ohio. They don't want to go back to the States where it's awful. They're like, you know, I would rather be in China than back in the U.S.
Scott Tong is in China for us, Beijing this time around. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, Kai. Thanks.
Back in better times, Wall Street was one of the biggest destinations for graduates of MBA programs, Masters of Business Administration trying to become Masters of the Universe. Now that Wall Street's in ruins, though, you might expect the schools that mint those MBAs would be in trouble, too. Lower demand for their product from one of their main customers, right? But it turns out, actually, that just the opposite is happening. From Chicago Public Radio, Adrian Hill reports that as the economy sinks, applications to MBA programs are on the rise.
The admissions office at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management is buzzing.
You should bring with you one copy of your resume.
It's slammed with prospective students, all in their business best, waiting nervously for interviews. The phones are humming, too, with applicants making plans to visit. The school has had to hire additional people to help handle the rise in demand for places. That makes prospective students like Tom Sternwise nervous.
It's definitely made me a little bit more wary. Based on the increase in competition.
Right now, Sternwise works at a private equity firm in New York. He's been eyeing business school for a while.
Looking to kind of change industries, and I think the easiest way to do that, or the best way to do that, with the opportunity to see a lot of different, vantage points in different industries, is to go through an MBA process.
For Sternwise, an MBA is a way to be more competitive down the line. Others turn to business school when they lose their jobs. Beth Fly is an assistant dean at Kellogg. She says she's curious to see whether the school will be overrun by refugees from the financial sector.
It's quite early, and I have not yet seen a significant difference. However, that could be more prominent once we, you know, have the full set of information on this round.
J.
Just like Tom Sternwise, those applicants will encounter stiff competition for places. Wannabe MBAs have taken a record number of B-school tests this year. Fly says one of their biggest concerns is how they're going to pay for the program. Tuition alone is nearly $47,000 a year.
Looking at the news with some of the banks and the tightening on the credit markets, there's some concerns right now.
Students are worried loans might be hard to come by or rates could rise. Stacy Cole is a deputy dean at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, where applications are up 20% this year. She says uncertainty about the credit environment is matched by students' worries about what kind of jobs will be available when they graduate.
I think in a good year, in a good market, everyone assumes they'll get a job. Today, there's more probing on this front.
She says students are anxious to position themselves properly, and they're grilling admissions officers about the school's network.
What's the set of companies in this industry that the school has a relationship with? Do you have alumni in this field? Will alumni talk to me?
Cole says there's good reason to be nervous. Some recruiters have canceled networking events for second years. She says with some of the big brands out of the hiring picture, students are looking at firms and jobs they might not have considered. And that's not a bad thing.
Students have to think harder about what it is that they want in an employer. Is it geography? Is it function? Is it the mix of colleagues? Is it the set of clients that you'll work with?
Cole says students are being forced to consider what they really want to get out of the degree. And that means they'll be more likely to end up with a job they're happy with. In Chicago, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to send you into the weekend. Next time you're on Google, do a quick search for vodka or whiskey. Plenty of results, but no ads featuring hard liquor. That and a ban on beer have been longstanding Google policies. Wine's been okay, champagne too. But in what may be a sign of the changing economic times, it is now okay to advertise beer through a Google search ad. He wasn't talking about this issue specifically, but a couple of weeks ago, Google CEO Eric Schmidt told Bloomberg, quote, you know, in a recession, people search for different things. I guess companies search for new revenue streams too, don't they? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday. Today, the Dow rose 144 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ added 22 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 hiked up 10 points, 1.1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Our coverage of the financial crisis continues this weekend on our personal finance program. Marketplace Money is the name. And coming up Monday on this broadcast, credit card companies change the terms of agreement.
And I think from their fear, they're throwing this blanket out over a bunch of us that they don't have any idea who or what is under the blanket.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.